From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Later in the broadcast, we'll be joined by Kathleen Dumé, a member of the House of Delegates of the Maryland General Assembly. Joining us in studio now is Mark Herring. He is the Attorney General for the Commonwealth of Virginia. He's a Democrat who is running for re-election. Mark Herring, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and it's great to be back on the show.
Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with the Current Newspapers. And Tom Sherwood, welcome. Your column this week had devoted a great deal of space to a former politician in Washington. Now that she's a former politician, I guess I can say she's one of my favorite former politicians, but then she might decide to run again, and I may have disqualified myself from talking about her. But we're talking about Carol Schwartz. She has written a memoir that's not exactly 140 characters, is it?
Well, if you have any door that needs to be propped open, you don't need a brick. 745 pages, self-published, $30 that includes sales tax. Carol Schwartz, who has been on the political scene of the city for 40-something years, maybe longer, school board, community activist, council, five-time candidate for mayor. She has written a book. I went to a little book party for her this week at the Pont Italian Kitchen. First thing I should tell people is, and my column makes this point, she's not running again.
Good.
In the next mayor choice. But, you know, she tells quite a story. I said, yeah, it was a pretty long book. She said, well, it could have been 1,500 pages. It's my life, not a tweet. So, and it goes from it's some very sad parts that she talks about her growing up in Midland, Texas, with an abusive father and how she had to overcome that and the frightfulness of being a four-year-old and seeing your father throw a pot of hot soup at your mother. She talks about being Jewish in a town with very few Jews.
In Midland, Texas.
But she also talks about her extraordinary, her successes in politics here. She talks about how Marion Barry, the former mayor, used to hit on her all the time.
So what's new?
Well, that's what she said. She said she would have been this is a very serious subject these days. I don't want to be too flip about it, but she said she would have been offended that, you know, Barry hit on everyone and he didn't hit on her. And that she said it wasn't sexual harassment like we're seeing today in horrific numbers. She said, I was an equal. I was a political figure. I wasn't a subordinate. And so, but he was quite interesting. And she talks about her successes in the council and the people she's run against, and it's pretty interesting. Now, I want to remind you very quickly, she's a member of the Board of Ethics and Government
correct.
Accountability, and she didn't let the board know that she was writing this book. So, you know, she'll be sitting in judgment of some people who maybe are in the book. I don't know how that's going to play out.
We'll have to see. On to Virginia before we get to our candidates specifically. Maryland Governor Hogan is going to be going to Virginia to campaign for Republican Ed Gillespie. How significant is that in your
Well, view? I was trying to see where I was looking. I heard about that. But where is he going to precisely be? I could not find. I don't know if he's going to go and just stand on the tiptoe of the 14th Street
Bridge. It says in Northern Virginia.
Well, that's a very big place. You know, I'd like more details. Maybe the governor's office can call in and tell us.
How important is that, you think?
Yeah, I think Mr. Herring could answer that question.
Well, I think whenever other notable elected officials come in to campaign, it helps bring awareness that there's an election around the corner, helps generate some turnout. I was campaigning in Richmond a few days ago with Senator Kamala Harris, who was in town to campaign with us, and former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder. And so, you know, having surrogates like that come in and campaign can help generate interest and news and reminds people there's an election coming up.
It might remind some of the people in Virginia that, you know, Governor Hogan has gone out of his way to avoid being identified with President Trump. Ned Gillespie has been the candidate for governor in Virginia. Is a Republican, is trying very hard to walk that tight line between acknowledging that President Trump is the president, but that doesn't want to be tied to him in any way. So we'll see how Governor Hogan finesses that, because that's the first thing the Virginia reporter would ask him is, well, you've distanced yourself from the president. What do you think about Mr. Gillespie and his campaign?
On to the candidate at hand. This is a somewhat unusual race, Mark Herring. You're the first Democrat to hold the office of Attorney General in 20 years, the first to run for re-election in nearly 30 years. Most seem to use the post as a launching pad for governor. Why do you want to stay in this job for another 4 years?
Well, again, thank you for having me on the show. And, you know, it is unusual for a Virginia Attorney General to run for re-election. The tradition has been to run for governor, you know, and that happens very quickly, oftentimes in a term. But this is a job that can really positively impact the lives of so many people. And I could see that with the right person at the helm, you know, the Attorney General can do a lot to help Virginians. And that's why I'm running for re-election. I've been out campaigning and reminding folks the incredible work that my team and I have been doing over the last 4 years. Things like bringing Virginia leading the state's charge on the heroin and the opioid epidemic that is touching the lives of so many families, combining tough enforcement against dealers and traffickers with innovative prevention and education and treatment initiatives. And we are transforming how Virginia is responding to sexual and domestic violence, working to eliminate a decades-old backlog of untested sexual assault kits. That means perpetrators could still be out there that need to be brought to justice. Survivors need the support, and I'm not going to stop until every kit's tested. Survivors know the results, and each case gets a fresh look. We've been fighting for taxpayers and seniors every single day. My Medicaid fraud unit has returned $70 million to taxpayers. And we've regalvanized our consumer protection section, putting a special focus on things like protecting service members and veterans and their families. And, you know, Kojo, a lot of your listeners may not realize it, but those who commit financial fraud and scams often target military members and their families because they're often away from home and have a steady income, and we've gotten $100 million back in relief for them.
Tom Sherwood is so glad you've gotten that out of the way, because he usually interrupts the opening statement. So allow me to get...
I was about to, and let me just say this.
Allow me to get one more question. In your first run for office, you made the case that your predecessor, Ken Cuccinelli, had turned the office into a highly ideological and activist instrument of the right. You promised repeatedly to take politics out of the office. Yet one of your first moves in office was to take on Virginia's ban on gay marriage, which I'll note you voted for that ban as a state senator. You're charged with making the office as ideological and as activist as your predecessor did. What's your response?
Well, they're wrong on that. And standing up and protecting the rights of Virginians is not political. It's standing up for Virginians. That's what an attorney general should be doing. And, you know, that decision, and first of all, let me just say that when I talked about taking the politics out of the office, I was talking about how my predecessor was bending and twisting the law in order to impose policies on Virginians that were way outside the mainstream, going after a climate change researcher, giving bad legal advice to the Board of Health that led to regulations that threaten the closure of women's health clinics. And that's what my opponent wants to bring us back to. And so what I've been doing is making sure that the office is focused on helping Virginians and protecting them and keeping them safe, protecting their rights, and this is really important, making sure that all of our actions are firmly grounded in the law. And on the marriage equality case, every court we went in front of agreed with us that the ban was unconstitutional.
Why did you vote for it when you were in the Senate?
Well, you know, I was working...
How long ago was this?
It was 2006.
Okay.
So over 10 years ago, 11 years ago. And I was working to eliminate discrimination wherever I saw it, but I stopped short on marriage equality, and I saw how that decision really hurt people. And I listened to my constituents, I talked to family, I talked to friends, and I came to see it very differently, just like millions of Americans everywhere. And so since then, I have continued to fight for marriage equality and to protect families.
Your Republican opponent, John Adams, has a great name. He was on this program a week or so ago, 2 weeks ago. He's very conservative. He was against same-sex marriage, marriage equality. He's against abortion. He's very conservative. But he says, as the state's attorney, that he will he will defend the state's laws regardless of his political positions. It's my view as a reporter who's covered politics a lot, that you can't take politics out of things that involve elective politics. It just makes no sense. What is your biggest complaint or your strongest position against John Adams, who wants to take your job?
Well, you know, he says he wants to take the politics out of the office, but yet he's incredibly political. And, Tom, you identified it. If you look at his website, I mean, it is all about banning abortion in all cases, including rape and incest. He got into this. And, by the way, it's not just a personal view he holds, but he questions the legal underpinnings of Roe versus Wade, which has been legal precedent in this country for half a century. And to have an attorney general who questions the legal underpinnings of Roe versus Wade is very disturbing. And he got into this race because of his anger over how I brought Virginia into the fight for marriage equality. And we won. We were right on the law. And had he been in office and defended it, he would have been wrong on the law.
He's a member of the McGuire Woods law firm. It's the biggest law firm, I think, maybe the most influential law firm in Virginia. Does that have any bearing on this in this race at all?
Well, he has been a white-collar criminal defense lawyer defending and protecting powerful corporations and wealthy executives who are accused of crimes and other legal wrongdoing. And that's what he's been doing and making a career out of over the last 7 or 8 years, oftentimes sitting right across from either investigators or prosecutors in my office or other state attorneys general or the Department of Justice. So he has been defending those, and where I have been standing up and fighting for Virginians, and yet he still won't disclose who his clients are. It creates potential conflicts of interest if he's been representing those who may be under investigation. And so, you know, the question for Virginia voters is going to be, who do you want as your attorney general? Someone who has been fighting for special interests and wealthy corporate executives accused of legal wrongdoing, or someone like me who has been standing up fighting for consumers, fighting for all Virginians?
We got an email from Nancy who says, earlier this year, you settled an equal pay lawsuit for $200,000 with Anne Marie Reardon, an attorney who worked in your office. Why did you fire her rather than paying her the same as her male counterparts?
You know, I'm glad she wrote in with the question, because John Adams has been putting a lot of misinformation. He doesn't have his facts straight, and his ads are totally distorted and wrong. The situation that she's talking about was the product of a decision made at the time of hiring in 2010 under a previous administration. In 2010, I was not the attorney general. I was in the state senate. And so let me be clear. I support equal pay for equal work. I support women's rights, including health care and reproductive rights. And women in Virginia should be concerned about John Adams' positions on those. They need to know that they've got an attorney general who will stand up and fight for them. I have been doing that, and I'll continue to do it.
I was trying to Google this earlier today. She won a settlement on payment. She got $200,000. Has she taken a position in the campaign? I haven't heard. Maybe she hasn't. I have missed it. Are you aware of it?
I'm not aware of it, and you know, I'm limited in what I can say because it was a settlement. But
I'm only asking has she publicly. Is there a non-disclosure statement that she cannot speak about it?
As I said, I'm limited in what I can say, okay. But I can tell you that was a product of a decision made at the time of hiring back in 2010 under a previous administration.
But I would assume that if she wanted to endorse someone for office, she could do that without getting into any details about that case. Okay. If somebody knows, send us a tweet or something with what she's done, if anything.
About a month ago, a Republican-led legislative commission requested a review of your office, including how the office has used the money from asset forfeitures, examining pay raises, and how contracts are reviewed. Regardless of any possible political motivation, I'm pretty sure you feel there is some. Do you have any concerns about that review? And can you address how the office handles each of those areas?
Yeah. Well, again, we've entered that part of the campaign where all kinds of political shenanigans happen. Adams has some friends in the legislature who want to try to make something that isn't there. And you know what? A week before they did that, the General Assembly did their own audit and gave us a clean audit. So, you know, they've looked at everything. And our Medicaid fraud, I mentioned this earlier, our Medicaid fraud unit that they want to take a look at, supposedly, has returned $70 million to taxpayers. And let me tell you what that means. First of all, it means that taxpayers are getting the money when others take advantage of our systems. And so that's really important to protect taxpayers. But when there is fraud like that, it also means that the care that is supposed to go to some of our most frail elderly citizens in Virginia isn't getting delivered. And so this is really important. And the Office of Inspector General had called us one of the best Medicaid fraud units in the country.
Here is Lewis in Leesburg, Virginia. Lewis, you're on the air. Put your headphones on, gentlemen. Lewis, go ahead, please.
Yes. How you doing, Mark? I'm from Leesburg. How are you?
Good. My hometown.
All right. Yes. Mark, help me understand this. You are the incumbent. You've been the general now here for many years, and you have a person that you're running against that really is sort of a no-name, hasn't been in the public eye before. But every time I hear you talk, especially about him, you're going at him like a banshee. I mean, you are just attacking that guy like he is the you're just really going at him. I don't understand it. You're the incumbent. You're the force. You're the force. You're the person that's been there. And why do you feel, I mean, you started in.
Wait a minute. Do you feel he'd do a better job if he simply ignored his opponent?
That's a really good question. Let me best answer that. It's like, well, if you're really the person who's been successful and accomplished a lot, you mostly focus on your record and maybe spend a little bit of time on that. But the ads that I've seen starting back in August have been voracious against this man.
Okay, allow me to have Mark Herring respond.
Well, it's a good question, and I'm glad he asked, because I love to talk about the accomplishments that my team and I have done, whether it has been, and I've talked about a few of them, on leading the charge on the state's heroin and opioid epidemic. You know, we are relentless in going after the dealers and traffickers who profit off addiction. We did Operation Riptide and arrested dozens involved in heroin trafficking rings. We've transformed how Virginia is responding to sexual and domestic violence, not just with eliminating the decades-old backlog of untested rape kits, but leading the way and making Virginia a national leader in how we're addressing campus sexual violence.
Lewis gave him the opportunity to do the statement.
We have regalvanized our consumer protection section. We have recovered $250 million for Virginia consumers in debt relief and restitution. We are going after violent gang members. We have created the Hampton Roads Human Trafficking Task Force, literally putting human traffickers behind bars and making sure that the victims of human trafficking have the support in the community they need to get to a safe place and begin to rebuild their
Mark
lives.
Mark Herring is the Attorney General for the Commonwealth of Virginia. He's running for re-election. He is a Democrat. He joins us in studio, of course, with Tom Sherwood, our resident analyst, who's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with the current newspapers. Questions or comments for Mark Herring, 800-433-8850, or send us a tweet at Kojo Show, email to kojo@wamu.org, because the lines seem to be filled.
Okay, let's get to the commercials. Let's get to the advertising. There have been complaints that both Ralph Northam, the Democrat, and Ed Gillespie are doing really, really harsh ads or supporting harsh ads from supporting groups. Particularly, and this is in your area, MS-13, the gang. The Gillespie campaign has gone very hard against Ralph Northam, saying that he's soft on the crimes. And I want you to answer that for him today because he's not here. He had a press conference this week. I went to in Alexandria with the sheriff and the prosecutor in Alexandria, who said that this is an outrageous charge. But what about the tenor of the gubernatorial ads? What do you think about them?
Well, you know, some of those ads that Ed Gillespie has run are terribly misleading and race baiting, and we can have differences of opinion, but you know there needs to be some semblance of truth. The notion that somebody like Ralph Northam was somehow soft on gangs and violence is ludicrous. This is somebody who is an Army veteran, a pediatric neurologist, and you know here's where we both are. If anyone in Virginia commits crimes, we are going to make sure the law is enforced. We are going to hold them accountable and bring them to justice, no matter who they are. And my office is the same way. We've been doing that for the last 4 years, and we'll continue to do that.
How serious is the gang problem in Northern Virginia, particularly?
Particularly the gang known as MS-13.
MS-13, yeah.
Well, as I said, we are combating gangs and gang violence every way we can. We are combating it with prosecutions. We just got a prosecution a couple of weeks ago of a violent gang member. We've broken up gang members who are involved in narcotics trafficking and human trafficking from Northern Virginia to Hampton Roads to Southwest Virginia. And one of the real challenges has been here in Northern Virginia has been that Congress has cut funding for the Northern Virginia Gang Task Force. And we need that funding restored. We're doing everything we can to fill the gaps and doing everything we can to prevent it. And we'll be relentless in continuing to do it.
There's a heated debate at the top of the ticket. Lieutenant Governor Northam has gotten a lot of blowback for reversing course and saying he never supported sanctuary cities and would oppose them in Virginia. The progressive group known as Democracy for America is pulling support for him over this issue. What would you say to Democratic supporters who are wavering in the final days of this campaign?
Well, I would say this, that we've got a great ticket. Ralph Northam is someone who has a tremendous record of service. He is going to keep focused on jobs and the economy and health care and education and build on the success that we've already had here in Virginia. Our current governor, Terry McAuliffe, you know, we are proud to be a part of that team and his administration that was able to move our unemployment rate from 5.4%, where we started when we came into office, down to 3.7%. Over 210,000 jobs have been created and $18.5 billion of new capital investment. So these are real issues that we're working on, and we're going to keep people safe. As Attorney General, I'm working every single day to keep Virginians and their families safe, and we are aggressively going after gang violence, human trafficking, making Virginia a national leader in how we
respond. Do you find yourself during the campaign also getting sucked into the culture wars? It seems that in the late stages of every campaign, that seems to just take over.
Well, to be clear, there's some very clear contrast between John Adams and myself on important issues that matter to Virginia. He wants to roll back marriage equality and use the powers of the office to roll it back. He questions the legal underpinnings of Roe versus Wade and believes that abortion should be banned in all cases. He wants to limit access to birth control. He went to the Supreme Court twice to limit access to birth control, including in the Hobby Lobby case. And on health care, as Attorney General, I have gone to court to fight to protect health care. Hundreds of thousands of Virginians had their health care threatened.
You may have answered Ruben's question in West Springfield. Ruben wants to know what you can do to keep health care affordable. Ruben is afraid his premiums are about to go up big time.
Well, he should be concerned, and a lot of Virginians are concerned about it. I talk to Virginians all across the state, and an Attorney General can do a lot to protect people's access to health care. When I came into office, there was a legal challenge that threatened to take away the premium subsidies that low and moderate income Virginians relied upon to get health insurance on the exchanges. My predecessor had taken up the side of those who wanted to take it away. And I came in and I said his legal theories were flimsy. I'm going to take up the side of the people. We went all the way to the Supreme Court and won, and I'm going to continue to fight for quality, affordable health care.
It's a cliche that the race is heating up, but in fact it's winding down as the get-out-the-vote effort is up. All across the state, Democrats and Republicans are doing everything they can to get people to vote on Tuesday. President Trump has there's some debate about whether President Trump, who's tweeted twice in the favor of Mr. Gillespie, would come in. He didn't. He's gone to Asia. As you mentioned off air, he could also tweet from Asia. But this is seen as a national race. In the big picture of when people around the country are looking at New Jersey, which appears to be headed for the Democrats, Virginia's the purple state, the competitive state, that it will be an endorsement for the President Trump if the Republicans win. It'll be a setback for the Democrats if they lose. What should people around the region and around the country think as they look at the Virginia race?
Well, first of all, Tom, we are not going to lose. We are going to win. And as I crisscross the state, talk to folks, not just here in Northern Virginia, but you know, everywhere else in Virginia, they're excited about this race. And I think it's because of the record of accomplishments that my team and I are able to talk about that we want to continue, whether it is the work on the heroin and opioid epidemic or sexual domestic violence, our protection for veterans and military families.
The Trump effect.
Yeah.
It cuts both ways, obviously, because Mr. Gillespie wants the Trump supporters out for him.
Well, you know, it's difficult to say what the effect of Donald Trump is going to be you know, but what I'm focused on is the work I've been doing as Attorney General and making sure that I'm out there protecting Virginians. And, you know, sometimes things that the president does might require some legal action, like when he overstepped legal and constitutional boundaries with his illegal, unconstitutional, and un-American Muslim ban.
You joined with a number of other Democratic attorneys general to legally challenge that so-called Muslim ban. And after a terror attack in New York earlier this week, President Trump has called for extreme vetting, and he's blamed decisions by judges and moves by attorney generals like yourself for making the nation less safe. What is your response?
He is wrong on that. And number one, we were standing up for the rights of Virginians. Number two, national security experts said that the Muslim ban that he imposed not only did not have any basis in national security, it made us less safe. It made us more vulnerable. And so these are actions that I took that were necessary to protect Virginians. Now, some of the things that the president may do may require other action that's not necessarily legal. For example, but nevertheless falls under the purview of the Attorney General's office. For example, I talked about the work we've done on campus sexual violence to change the culture, to really support survivors. And we have an education secretary who wants to roll back protections of Title IX. And so what we need to do as a state is to continue the progress that we've made, notwithstanding the direction that Donald Trump wants to take it.
Charlottesville was a terrible incident this past August. It has revved up the ongoing debate over Confederate monuments and imagery. I was in Christ Church in Alexandria this past week where that Episcopal Church has decided to move to 1870 plaques of George Washington and Robert E. Lee from the sanctuary and reposition them on church grounds to avoid keep politics out of the worship service. Corey Stewart, the Republican from Prince William County, came to the church this week and complained. It said, next they'll take Christ off the name of the church. He's called on Ed Gillespie to be tougher on preserving and protecting Confederate monuments. Mr. Gillespie has moved in that direction, but where are you on the Confederate monument thing?
Well, I think each locality, each community should have a thorough and inclusive conversation about it and decide for themselves what the future of the monuments are going to be in their communities. Local communities decided they could go up. Local communities ought to be able to decide whether they should come down after a very inclusive conversation about it. And maybe that's my local government background coming out in me, but I know that in those kinds of decisions, it's really important for a lot of voices to be heard, for people to feel like they've been able to express their opinion, and then the leaders in the community can begin to make a decision on what the future should be. Further on Charlottesville, the next day, I was with the governor, the lieutenant governor in Charlottesville to talk to folks, and it was a traumatic thing, a trauma, really, that happened to the city and the people there. But I also saw a lot of hope and resilience. That's a community that is committed to equality and inclusiveness, and Virginia is committed to it as well. And we have to make it clear, leaders have to make it clear, that the kind of hatred and bigotry that we saw from neo-Nazis and neo-Confederates and KKK will not have any home anywhere in our
Commonwealth. Well, Kerry in Richmond, Virginia would like you to be more specific about that. So put on your headphones, please, so you can hear Kerry. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. After Trump was inaugurated, there was a spike in hate crimes across the country. What are you going to do to prevent hate crimes in Virginia?
Well, and are there state laws that are involved?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, and I'm concerned about the rise in hate crimes as well. There's been a 21% increase in hate crimes in Virginia, including here in Northern Virginia. There was a Jewish school that received a bomb threat. There was anti-Hindu graffiti spray painted on some bridges and other walls. An old school had been spray painted with racial epithets. And, you know, that kind of hate and discrimination and harassment has no place in our Commonwealth. So what I did last year was propose additional authority for my office to prosecute those hate crimes in case we can no longer count on the Department of Justice to do it. And those initiatives were defeated by Republicans in the General Assembly, but I'm not going to give up. And in addition, whenever that has happened, I have made it clear that Virginia is not going to tolerate hate crimes, that they're those minority communities, whether they're racial or religious minorities, have they are welcome here in Virginia. They belong here. They are a part of our Commonwealth, and we are glad they're here.
About a minute and a half.
I think we kind of breezed by sanctuary cities. That's another attack against the Democrats who are running. Are there sanctuary cities in Virginia, and what is a sanctuary city?
Well, let me be clear about a couple of things. First of all, there are no sanctuary cities in Virginia. Even Ed Gillespie in his one of his gubernatorial debates admitted Virginia does not have sanctuary cities. And when it comes to crimes or gang violence, I'm going to make sure that Virginia's laws are enforced no matter who you are, no matter where you come from. If you commit a crime in Virginia, you are going to be brought to justice and held accountable.
Final question. National attorneys general groups on both sides have put money into yours and your Republican opponents' races. Virginia has no limits on campaign donations, and the Commonwealth allows outside groups to coordinate directly with campaigns. Is that an issue in your view, and is there something that could be done to address it?
Well, the amount of money that the National Republican Attorneys General Association has poured into my opponent's campaign should be a concern to Virginia, to Virginians. They have put $6.7 million.
How much did you get from National Attorneys General?
A little over $2 million. So it's different.
Three times.
And you know, and so most the majority of his support has come from them. And where do they get their money? The NRA and some dark money groups like Koch Brothers and Judicial Crisis Watch and others. So you know, that's where he's getting his support from. I've got 24,000 individual contributors. Over 90% of them, 22,000 of them, are under $100. That's because my campaign is really people-powered. It's driven by people and Virginians, and that reflects the kind of attorney general I've been. I believe the attorney general is the people's lawyer. And as the people's lawyer, I am accountable to them, and I'll always make sure the powers of the office are on the side of the people.
Mark Herring is the attorney general for the Commonwealth of Virginia. He's running for re-election. He's a Democrat. Thank you for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thank you for having me back.
We didn't get to the attorney general sessions going back to the war on drugs.
No, we can't get
but
to it.
I suspect I know his answer.
We're out of time, unfortunately.
Tom Sherwood
is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with the Current newspapers. Tom, what the heck is going on at the United Medical Center? The members of the city council this week were clearly upset that a 47-year-old UMC nursing home resident died August 25th. He had a heart attack, but he'd been left on the floor for at least 20 minutes by his caregivers, and that's not the only controversy that we've seen coming out of UMC. What can we expect to be done in the future?
Well, the council, the D.C. council next week, this coming week, is due to vote on the $4 million contract for the Veritas company that runs the hospital. It has raised there have been any number of questions about the quality of care, who's in charge. I think we discussed this last week, that they're looking for an executive director to run it. There's been some approach to George Washington University to run the emergency room. The fact is that the city, whether it's Vince Gray from Ward 7, the chairman of the health committee, or Mayor Muriel Bowser, people are thrashing about, but we have not yet found in this city how that hospital is going to continue to operate and actually serve the people who desperately need it. That's
the
still a big
that
open
part
question.
Part of the city's only public hospital. Joining us in studio now is Kathleen Dumais. She is a member of the House of Delegates in the Maryland General Assembly. She's a Democrat representing District 15 in Montgomery County. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Did I pronounce your name correctly?
You did.
Good.
It took me a while. I didn't, you know, get back. It's a French pronunciation.
It is.
Legislators in Maryland now seem ready to support a bill terminating the parental rights of rapists. Maryland is one of 16 states that has no such law, though you've sponsored measures for the past 9 years. What is the situation now for rape victims? Can their rapists assert parental rights?
Yes, they can. And sometimes they do. The bill actually, when it first came to me, came from two sources. One was adoption lawyers, where they talked about if they were representing a woman who came to them and was pregnant, wanted to carry the child to term, but wanted to give the child up for adoption, were shocked when their lawyer said, but you need to get the consent of the father or the putative father. And if they had been raped, they didn't want to consult or confront their assaulter and or the rapist And so sometimes they would just walk away. This is the only bill on this particular issue. The Catholic Conference and NARAL sit at the table together, because what happens many times is a woman will go and decide to have an abortion. The other way it came is from the Child Protective Services in Montgomery County. There was a horrible case where a stepfather raped a 13-year-old girl repeatedly. She became pregnant. She had the child. And when she was 18, she was having severe mental health issues, was institutionalized, and Child Protective Services came in to take the child. Guess who sued for custody? Fortunately, in that case, family and Child Protective Services were able to work it out so that the stepfather did not get custody of the child. But what we don't have is a process, and I think that's a misunderstanding sometimes about this bill. The bill creates a process, a claim for someone to take it to court and say, I would like the parental rights of the alleged rapist terminated. It's a court process. It has to be proven by clear and convincing evidence, which is a high civil standard. And we have built in multiple protections for the respondent or the alleged rapist in order to be, you know, we're balancing victims' rights and due process.
That's what you fought for this bill. I mean, I don't know of anyone on any side who says that a rapist should have parental rights on the child that he has created from the rape. The judges and all the lawyers have said, but, you know, you can't judge that person as a rapist until he is convicted in court. And until that time, if he is deemed to be the father, then he has parental rights, right? That's where we are. And so how is your bill significantly written coming this year so that it will, in fact, pass? Because one of the concerns or one of the opportunities mm-hmm. is that there could still be a civil action where a mother could go and take into civil action and say, I want this person to have nothing to do with my child. But what does your law say there, and when do you think it might pass this time?
Well, first, the reason that the termination of parental rights is a civil action. It is not a criminal action. But
does it determine on the basis of whether the person's been convicted of the rape?
If the person's been convicted, then yes, that is a basis for a termination of parental rights. Okay. But the bill does not require a conviction. And one of the things that I think is important to understand is that many times rapes aren't reported. And 5% of rape victims between the ages of 12 and 45 become pregnant. 5.9% place the children for adoption, 32.2% keep the child, 50% terminate the pregnancy, and 11.8% tend to miscarry. But more importantly is, of the rapes that occur, very few are actually reported, and even the ones that are reported often aren't criminally convicted.
Politically, though, do you think you have the key committee chairs to move forward this coming session?
Yes, we do.
And well, can you name names?
Sure. Number one, each year we have put the bill in, we've had at least 85 sponsors in the House, and we've had at least 35 sponsors of the 47 members of the Senate. There are 141 members of the House of Delegates. What's important at the moment is it has garnered enough interest now that we are going to pre-file it, and the sponsor in the House will be myself and Speaker Bush, and in the Senate, it's Senator Brian Feldman and Senator Mike Miller, President Miller.
If the standard is not conviction of the rape, what mm-hmm. would be the standard be under your bill for denying parental rights to an accused rapist?
It is clear and convincing evidence, which is a civil standard. A long time ago when I used to teach high school, I would talk about the normal or regular standard in civil cases is preponderance of the evidence, which means someone just needs to prove by 51% and they then are successful in the civil case. Obviously, beyond a reasonable doubt, when you talk to legal scholars, it means it's 99.9% certain that, in fact, the crime was committed and the person's convicted. Clear and convincing evidence, depending upon the legal scholar you speak to, is somewhere between 70% and 80% or 70% and 85%. So, you know, one of the things that I believe is that we need to place appropriate kind of decision in the hands of the judges. It's not a slam dunk. This isn't going to happen automatically. Someone's going to have to bring a claim. there's going to be defense. And the kinds of protections we've put in is that the evidence that is deduced at that trial for the in the civil case cannot be used in a subsequent criminal proceeding, which, you know, and we're also saying that if usually in a civil proceeding, if someone testifies and it's against their interest, it can be used in a subsequent criminal proceeding. So this is a major change. The other thing is usually if you take the Fifth Amendment in a civil case, the inference can be that, in fact, you did commit the crime or that you are guilty. We've indicated that inference does not apply in these cases.
How often does a person either accused of or convicted of rape attempt to have parental rights? I can't imagine that it happens. Maybe I don't know. What is the answer?
And that we don't have great numbers, but really the Maryland Coalition Against Sexual Assault is the group that I've worked the most with. Over the course of a year, they see maybe 5 or 6 of these cases. So we're not looking at a lot of cases. Again, it's not all rapes. We're limiting it to just those that result in a pregnancy.
And you have spent a great deal of time on this. Why?
Because I do believe it's important for a woman to be able to have a child if that's what she determines she wants to do and either be able to give it up for adoption or be able to raise the child, if that's her choice, without necessarily needing to think that every other weekend I need to take the child to the person that
assaulted.
Having
been violated once, right. Not to make it a lifelong.
That's correct.
The last failed attempt to pass this legislation was in the spring when no women were asked to serve on the committee charged with resolving the House and Senate versions of the bill. Was there an issue in terms of how this process was handled, and has that been the case in other instances over the past 9 years?
It has been. Now, in fairness to the 6 men that were appointed or were the committee, there were 2 that were on the House committee, Delegate David Moon and Delegate Brett Wilson, who was actually recently appointed to the Circuit Court in Washington County, were very much in favor and supported this bill. Part of it was timing. And actually Senator Will Smith on the Senate side is also a co-sponsor and a large advocate. One of the problems was the timing. And, you know, funny things happen on sine die, and it's usually all tied. And sine die, which is the last day of the session, and it's often tied to things that are unrelated. We had had a really rough and tumble time in the House Judiciary Committee about bail reform. So the chair wasn't a huge fan of this bill to begin with. He wasn't happy with what happened with bail reform. So all of it gets tangled when it's the last day.
Except that now it's shot to the top of the agenda. Leaders on both the
that's
House
right.
and the Senate have said this is going to be the first order of business that we take care of. So that's changed.
Is the current atmosphere, I want to ask you in a general question about rape being a horrific crime, but the harassment of women. We have seen these famous cases of actors and journalists and politicians, some of whom have lost their jobs because of their horrific treatment of women in particular, in some cases men. What about the general feeling that maybe now men in positions of power or just people in general should take more seriously the issue of the rights of women?
And I have seen
the big picture.
The big picture. And the big picture has been evolving for quite a number of years. In Maryland specifically, it became very clear when actually BuzzFeed did an article last September that talked about, I mean, the name of the article was Unfounded. And BuzzFeed had done a national investigation on how many cases of rape are unfounded. And the national statistic is supposed to be around 7%. Several of the counties in Montgomery, or in Maryland, Montgomery was at 24% unfounded. Baltimore County was at 34%. In 2010, Baltimore City had a problem where it was at 50%. And so I think this has been evolving, and really people are going to begin, I think people now understand what's not acceptable.
Me Too is the hashtag Me Too. Mm-hmm. In your own professional life, are you aware of women who have been terribly mistreated? I ask you personally if you want to answer, but we're at a defining moment in the country on this issue.
I think that's exactly right. And I, unfortunately, I've not been sexually harassed. I do see a difference in how women are treated sometimes in the legal field. Judge Lynn Battaglia in 2010, I believe, did a very thorough investigation and issued a report about gender bias in the legal field. And it does exist. And I talk a lot to young lawyers and young women in general and, you know, talk about how do you stand up to it. I mean, from a personal perspective, I've been very fortunate with the firms that I've been with over the course of my career and how I haven't felt it in the Circuit Court in Montgomery County. But I often talk about when I went to the legislature, that's sort of an entirely different culture. And when I was first elected and arrived in 2003, there were days I felt like I had was back in 1950 or earlier.
Mm-hmm. Sexism is rampant, was. It's less so now, but still rampant.
That's correct. I think. And then, you know, talking with women about how do you balance it? When do you say something? What is it that you say? And, you know, for instance, in committee hearings, some of my colleagues might say something that I would find absolutely outrageous. And balancing, is it time? Do I call them on it here in the public hearing, or do I talk to them later? And it really depended upon how outrageous the comment was.
And still she persisted.
Yes. Some 300 laws passed in the 2017 legislative session went into effect in Maryland last month, including measures addressing sexual assault. Mm-hmm. One major thing that's changed is that victims of sexual assault no longer have to prove that they resisted the attacker. Correct. Tell us more about what's changed and why it was important to address this.
It was important to address because, and actually, I had initially introduced that bill in 2005, and it got a very lukewarm reception and just stayed in the chairman's drawer. To be honest, Anthony Brown had introduced it in 2004. He wasn't in the legislature in 2005. He was in Iraq and as part of the Judge Advocate General Corps.
He's now in the U.S. Congress.
And he's now in the U.S. Congress. So the reason it was introduced, it seemed a good time, particularly after the BuzzFeed article, because there was a review of the Baltimore County cases done by Lisa Jordan from the Maryland Coalition Against Sexual Assault and a retired Judge Barbara Howe. And in reviewing the cases that were found to be unfounded, it was very clear that many officers, partly because of the way the Maryland law was written, if there wasn't an indication that the woman physically resisted, they simply didn't do any further investigation. And so we wanted to make it very clear that physical resistance is not required, and is not required even to prove threat of force, which is the way it was always interpreted. Our rape statute provides there has to be without consent, and there needs to be threat of force. And this simply says threat of force can come in lots of different forms, and that you don't have to physically resist in order to be able to prove rape.
I just want to point out that she joined the legislature in 2003, so it's not like the 1950s. It just felt like the 1950s.
It just felt like the 1950s. That's true. Thank you very much, just in case
anyone
thought.
You may have heard us speaking with Attorney General Herring earlier about immigration in so-called sanctuary cities. You co-sponsored the Trust Act last spring, which got national attention, including criticism from Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who said it would make Maryland more at risk for violence and crime. The Trust Act, however, did not pass, but why did you feel it was an important piece of legislation? What would it have accomplished?
The Trust Act, as it was eventually amended, and I worked hard with a work group that was put together to work on it, was really to make it clear that if you're in a local detention center, you cannot be held beyond what Maryland law would require. In other words, if you have been arrested and you are being detained, and then you eventually, your bond is set, or there's a provision that's set, you know, a supervision provision. We can't just hold you illegally waiting for an ICE detainer.
Unless the detainer comes.
Unless the detainer comes when you are still in legal custody in Maryland. It was really to be a policy call and to just send a message to law enforcement and to everyone in Maryland to make it clear. You know, it's not that we don't enforce ICE detainers. We do, and we should. But that for a lot of very minor crimes, if it's not, you know, someone's arrested for a traffic violation and they go before a commissioner and they're released on personal recognizance, that's not a basis to hold someone unless they have the ICE detainer in their custody.
Quick question. We're just out of time. You're a Democrat, Montgomery County. Governor Hogan, Republican, is going to go to Virginia to campaign for Ed Gillespie in that mm-hmm. campaign over there. There's a slew of Democrats running for governor in the state of Maryland. Senator Chris Van Hollen made news today. He's endorsing Rashearn Baker for governor. Ike Leggett has suggested Rashearn Baker is the right person. Where are you on the governor's race? This is a big, big change coming up in the politics.
It is a big change.
Where are you? We don't have a little time.
Okay.
So don't dance too much.
Don't dance too much. So I have not made a decision, but I will tell you that yesterday morning I actually met with Maya Rockamore Cummings, and I was very impressed. And I hope that we have a robust debate of all of the candidates, and we've got some good
options. She's the latest Democrat to be getting into the race,
right,
from Baltimore.
Kathleen Dumais, she's a member of the House of Delegates in the Maryland General Assembly. She's a Democrat representing District 15 in Montgomery County. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tom Sherwood, the D.C. East newspaper is part of a chain that apparently when two members of the chain employees attempted to unionize, that caused the owners of the chain to shut down the entire chain. We're also going to be losing the Washington City paper. You do a column for the current newspapers. How important are these, some would say, hyper-local?
Well, this is worthy of a whole show for you on this.
We're doing it on
Monday. We're losing our local media to see us. I mean, it's not just here, but in San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York City, Chicago, all these opportunities to have local news have been shut down because of this one owner's decision that he didn't want to do it because of the unionization. But we are losing our ability to know what's happening in the neighborhood and in the city hall and the state house.
Tom Sherwood, thank you as always. That's it for the show today, but there's a lot more for you to do this weekend online. You can download our podcast on iTunes or with whatever podcast service you choose. And you might want to catch up on any conversations you missed as we covered the run-up to next week's elections in Virginia at our website, kojoshow.org. You can find a digest that producer Ruth Tam compiled of all the conversations we conducted with statewide candidates during this general election. Don't forget to meet us back here Monday at noon. We'll be talking with the Prince George's County Police Chief. In the meantime, have a great weekend. Thanks for listening. I'm Kojo Namdi.
Thanks for listening to the Kojo Namdi Show, and if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.